Welcome back to the Jewish Futurism Lab, where we unpack Torah, tech, and tomorrow. I'm Mike Wirth, Jewish futurist, community artist, and design educator, coming to you from Crown Town, Charlotte, North Carolina. Today, we're diving into one of the most important Jewish schools you've probably never heard of, Franz Rosenzweig's Freies Jüdisches Lehrhaus, the Free Jewish House of Study in Frankfurt in 1920. It was a lab for Jewish learning in the middle of the Weimar Republic, where something radical happened when they treated Jewish learning as something you could design to fit modern life. We'll look at the problem he was solving, how Lehrhaus felt, and what it all looks like. I love the intro. It's such a great theme song. So friends, while I was working on my Hedor alum book series, I'm iterating on my core problem, right? Which is what facets and what dimensions of Jewish education are we still yet to unlock, right? What's out there still, right? I want to see. And, you know, we can use regular education as a way, secular education as a way to connect to new things and to also see overlap, which is great. And, you know, Hedor alum is essentially my attempt to scaffold Jewish creativity and spirituality, to build pages and prompts that help, you know, people like you and me, you know, not just rabbis or trained artists, to make beautiful, meaningful Jewish artwork, right? As a mode of expression, a valid expression, a valid midrash, right? A valid interpretation of something Jewish. And, you know, I wanted these books to function like a portable studio and a Beit Midrash kind of all in one, right? Like you can kind of like fold out the legs, like Kramer's coffee table book on that famous Seinfeld episode, if you've ever seen that, right? Imagine, little pop-up tent. I got it. It's coming, y'all. But I love that, like, it all happens in one space. And, you know, the structure itself is there to hold you as you experiment, you know, as you investigate where this is going. And at some point I realized I wasn't stuck on content, right? I was stuck on form. And, you know, what does it mean to design learning so that, you know, any person who doesn't think of themselves as religious enough or artsy enough can still find a way into the space? So I did what I always do and you know, trying to build something new. I went hunting through essays and research on Jewish adult education and experimental teaching from, you know, really just like the last 100 years or so. And I was looking for my allies in the past, right? People who have already wrestled with these questions, be them, you know, connected artistically and academically. And somewhere between reading many articles and papers on different websites and whatnot, a piece on Jewish learning about the Weimar Republic, right? And then I found this other essay called On Jewish Learning, right? Which was a translation from German to English. And these names just kept popping up and up and up, and it was Franz Rosenzweig, okay? So just like, all right, who's this guy? I just wanted to know so bad, like, who is this amazing person? And, you know, apparently he's created this beautiful system. How do I now get it to become something that I can learn from and really like use it to like, you know, nitro boost Hedor alum? Maybe he's learned things back in the day that like people were like, that's not, you know, valid and, you know, got locked up. But what's cool is as I was looking, you know, other people have learned about this. There's even a Lehrhaus in Boston, Massachusetts, which I'll tell you a little bit more about later. So writers were talking about his Lehrhaus in Frankfurt, like it was this, you know, legendary prototype for like the kind of spaces that we're trying to build now. Many of us are, you know, part Beit Midrash, part seminar, part community workshop, you know, all built into one beautiful space that oscillates and changes. And the more I read, the more I realized he wasn't just a philosopher with a giant book, right? Franz, okay? He was really a designer of Jewish learning, right? Down to the space, to the functionality of a space. I mean, he incorporated a lot of systems thinking, design thinking, empathy-led design, right? In the creation of this system. And in his essay on Jewish learning, he makes this simple but really this devastating observation. And it's here, I'll get it. It says, old school learning starts from Torah and moves out into life. But for modern Jews, you have to start in life and move back into Torah. Wow. You begin at the edge in people's work, in their fears. You meet them where they're at, right? Their art, their technology, their love, their politics, their existencehood, right? Their identity as a person. And you invite them to walk inward towards the center, right? And bring that whole self with you towards the center. You're not there to shed and, to become something else. You're there to be yourself, but on the inside, right? Going towards Torah and getting to Torah as the ultimate living system. It's a wonderful ultimate living system, in my opinion. And I think Rosenzweig's too. And when I read that, right, it hit me that like this is exactly what I've been trying to do with Hidur Olam. Start from where I am, right? Remember, Hidur Olam started out as me and me just like trying to figure out, well, what's going on with myself, creatively, spiritually, what's the overlaps, the connections. And I wanted to start where I was. I couldn't be anywhere else but where I was. So that was it. And what I was dealing with in terms of creative impulses. And then, I want to then gently lead people now into text, like I did, into practice and, spiritual reflection. Ultimately, you want to sit down and go, okay, I've read this stuff. I've thought about it. I've meditated. I've created art. Now, what does it mean? Right? Like, what am I meant to take from it? And you can start. Don't start deep, right? Don't start deep. Start at a place where you feel comfortable, where it makes a connection that makes sense to your life, right? Like, I've had secular times in my life where, I've thought, well, I don't know if I believe in God, right? Or maybe I've said, well, I'll call it the universe, okay? And we'll just say, oh, the universe, and that's easier to say. It's like there's been different times where I've had different feelings about how I connect to Hashem, to the universe, to different things, but always trying to think about like, well, what is it that is going to, take me, and what am I doing here? I always reflected on that. That's the important part. So the way that the book is scaffolded is, it starts to explain how I went through the process of doing the parashiyot, each parsha, right, reading the Torah, and which is a biggie. I wouldn't recommend that as a first one, right? Maybe start with a couple little Torah verses if you're not used to reading often. And this got me into a 54 artwork cycle, right, for the year, which was like huge. That was something that I gave myself prompts, and that's what I'm doing for folks is I'm turning then the prompts I used and saying, hey, here's what I've tested and used and works for me. Here's what I've tested and used in the classroom. And here's some stuff that like I thought of that maybe y'all could try, right? And you see what's what for you, what works best. And if you can modify, it's the whole thing about systems thinking is that use the parameters, but then develop it, make some hacks, make some things that push it to the next level. So, am I trying to make a printed Lairhouse? But no, maybe. I don't know. My book turning into a tent, the Mishkan, I think that's a pretty awesome thing. So we'll think about that. But maybe, right? Could it live up to the ideals of the Lairhouse? Maybe. There's a lot in the soil here that I really like. So we're going to keep going here to see, what's what, where things stand with this methodology. And I did know at this moment, though, this was a big moment. It was that if I'm serious about doing this Jewish futurism as teaching practice, right, through Hidur Olam, I have to bring Rosenzweig, Franz Rosenzweig, his ideas into the lab, right, here to the show to have an unpacking and an understanding about what's going on. So I want to share a little bit of the research that I did with y'all and things that I've come across that I thought were just interesting, that are relevant to what we're talking about here. So let's kind of zoom in to the world of Rosenzweig, right? And we're here now in Weimar, Germany, right? This is the time after World War I where the Republic of Germany under the Kaiser Wilhelm has now been defeated, right, by Allied forces, and it's a bummer. So World War I ends. A lot of things happen in World War I, oh my gosh, that impact the Jewish people. But here we're looking at Germany, right? Frankfurt, 1920. And, the empire has ceased, right? It's collapsed. And, the people are finding their way. And this is now a place that, like, if you're a historian, you would call the Weimar Republic, which was Germany's democratic government that lasted between 1919 and 1933, when some other folks took over. But this is a time when, like, amazing things in German arts happened, from German expressionism in cinema, right? Leading the world in cinema with, like, things like Fritz Lang's Metropolis, right? Fritz Lang, amazing German filmmaker, but wasn't allowed to live in the country after the folks in 1933 took over because of his heritage. If you didn't know, Fritz Lang's mother is Jewish, but he was raised Christian, I really believe a Lutheran. Anyhow, it created one of the most futurist films in history, Metropolis. If you've never seen Metropolis, it's an absolutely amazing, amazing film. And other treasures from the Expressionist canon, Nosferatu, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, wonderful, wonderful things. As well as things like the Bauhaus, right? The great Bauhaus Design School that was in Dessau and Weimar. That, like, were absolutely wonderful, wonderful things, that, like, brought the world a whole new revolution in design. And that was, like, a system that could be shared around the world. It ultimately became part of the international style, which, yeah, right, the Swiss really perfected, as well as the Americans. We did too, which was really great, right? Americanism, we got to come on, we got to give credit here for I know Americans were great at a lot of things, we say that all the time, but in this case for modernism, we can't just say Europe did it all, because most of the Europeans who created modernism as we see it and know it all studied the Prairie School. And the Prairie School comes from the great architect from Chicago, right? Who built Chicago and was the mentor to Frank Lloyd Wright. So when we talk about Prairie School, we're talking about Frank Lloyd Wright, right? And folks absolutely loved his work and studied. Walter Gropius, the famous director of the Bauhaus, first spoke of, oh, when I first saw Frank Lloyd Wright and the Prairie stuff, oh, amazing. It's like they saw that as, like, futuristic architecture, because here you were, they live in Germany where, things they know about Germany, they know what exists there. But in America, things are like going out west. It was like a frontier still. And what kind of home could you build out there, in the rugged, rugged land? So Frank Lloyd Wright did just that and did it with amazing geometric, algorithmic grace. And that's, like, one of the wonderful things. So anyway, sorry, my little side quest there. But let's stay here in Weimar, right? So these years between 1919 and 1933 are super chaotic and super creative, as we mentioned, right? Politically and in the streets, people have fights. There's street fights all the time between political groups because now you have a vacuum of power, right? What happens in this space when you have a vacuum of power? And there's hyperinflation. I mean, like a Deutschmark, what is it even worth, at a certain point? And at the same time, you also have rising anti-Semitism, right? And that's not just isolated. This is in a lot of places in Europe, especially 1919, big, big time. Okay, Russian Revolution, across the continent a little bit, and yeah, and we've got Weimar Republic now after World War I, as well as now. Right, the mandate of Palestine now occurring, and the dream of Eretz Israel, like, coming back to fruition. But things are changing, and as you mentioned, the explosion of film. We got to put theater in there, right? Cabaret, architecture, philosophy, and design, and we mentioned the examples before, the Bauhaus and Expressionist, experimental psychology and culture and things all happening in this space, in this new vacuum of power, this post-imperial Germany, right, in that time frame. And German Jews are at, if not all of the different parts of this, right, just plugged into all the different movements, the different schools and institutions. There was an ability to be able to be fluid in society at the time, more so than prior. So many fought in the war and they felt like they were loyal Germans and served the Kaiser and country, and were due what any other German who did the same is due. Yeah, but at the same time, feeling the betrayal of it. Some folks were surviving. Right, anti-Semitism didn't just like spike or it spiked at this point. It didn't just show up out of nowhere. That's an important thing to really say. At this point, the German Jews, they're people who are in academia. They're professors. They're bankers. They're lawyers, artists, journalists, doctors, right? They're in segments of government, things like that. And on the cultural level, a lot of them are more fluent in Goethe than they are in the Gemara. And yeah, this just at this time, Jewish options felt fractured. Some from the Jewish community at the time threw themselves into political Zionism, right? That had started in the 1800s and now was and was a German creation and by German Jews, and now was moving and growing, and there was a homestead and things like that and land purchase, right? This is how people were able to get to Palestine. They're not a colonization, it was a land purchase process, right? These folks have deeds, so bought by Arab and Ottoman landowners. So, I mean, this is how this came to be from the 1800s up until this time, and then up and before the War of Independence. Some folks that were on that political Zionist track, they were either in the process of planning or in absolutely making Aliyah, right, which is moving to the British Mandate of Palestine to help build a Jewish state. Like that was the call. This was land that was seized from an empire that had just fallen after hundreds and hundreds of years, the Ottoman Empire, right, which was one of the last Islamic empires in history, right, that went into the 1900s. They were the hegemony that conquered and took over and colonized that land. The Jewish presence that was had been consistently there since, forever, since even the time of the Romans and Jesus, to now, right? Up until that time, there had been a consistent, even though minority at times, sometimes majority, a Jewish presence, right? Still in Eretz Israel, in the land of Israel. And some folks are now embracing this cultural Zionism. You have to understand is that Zionism, being the connection of Jews to the land of Israel, right, as their home and having sovereignty in that space, right, is an indigenous call, right? It's an indigenous thought. So, at this time, Hebrew is being revitalized, right, and now being put into general use. So, if you move to Israel, you speak Hebrew now, right? Many spoke Yiddish, Ladino, right? All kinds of hodgepodge languages that combine ancient Hebrew, right? That was brought with whatever the host language was at the time. And they're doing this though, even while they're staying in Europe. They're saying, well, this is still important, even though I'm not going to necessarily go to live in the land of Israel right at this time and make emigration. I can still do this and be in Europe and still be a strong Jew, which is, I think, a wonderfully positive thing, right? There was a choice. And some folks here also lean into liberal assimilation, right? They think, right, they're Germans of the Mosaic faith, right? That's kind of like what they would say, when you would more traditionally think of a German, an ethnic German being Christian, right? And Protestant at that. But here now you have somebody of the Mosaic faith, right? So like this idea that Judaism and Christianity and Islam are just religions, right? Well, I would agree because Christianity and Islam are religions because they come through a declaration of faith. That's how you become one, right? But Jews are ethnically Jewish, and you don't just become, I mean, you can join the tribe, like any group can have people join. There's a method to do that. But People have the genetics, the DNA. You know, this is so much more than just a declaration of faith, right? So that's an important thing to say, is that, you know, people, Jews, are called that because of Judea, right? The kingdom of Judea. And after being displaced, Jews, right? That was their short name, after being scattered, right? Put into diaspora. But you know, that also meant that, like, Judaism then becomes something that you mostly do at home, right? And it's like maybe your ethics system, or maybe it's your heritage, and it's like you could easily then compartmentalize it there. It doesn't then exist as being part of a civilization. You're now, that gets surmounted by being now part of a nation, right? Being part of Germany. So that's now a new thing, right? But people embrace this, you know, just like we do now in America and in other places. You know, you're part of your nation first, and then you're Jewish, right? Because that we've all internalized this idea that, like, all we can just do as Jews is say, no, we're not Jewish. Like, come on. If I say, you know, I don't love the Torah, and, like, I reject it all, blah, 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 I'm still Jewish, like, regardless, and still accepted and appreciated. No one shuns me. I'm not going to hell, right? Like, none of that's coming for me, right? These things come later from other cultures and get superimposed, right? But that's how this is, this internalization. You know, it's interesting to see this kind of the system, you know, to address this thinking, this mentality of this idea, right? These are people who got through the Haskalah, right? The Enlightenment, where then Judaism could become compartmentalized in that way, right? Through German philosophy. And others, interestingly, are heading towards socialism and something called Bundism, right? And that's imagining a just society where Jews live as a protected minority, right? As part of of a revolution. And that's really rooted in Yiddish culture, right? And Rosenzweig here, he sees one more layer. And there's this whole class of Jews who are spiritually hungry, but educationally they can't find a home, right? They don't see themselves in a yeshiva. It feels foreign to them. And you know, universities, they treat Judaism sometimes like it's this, like, historic object, like, let's take it out of the case and look at Judaism, right? Like, it's like it died or something. Or, you know, maybe there's just people who, like, still practice it, like, there's still people who believe in Zeus or something, you know, like, and it's like, oy vey, you know, not that that's, you know, we're stuck. They're stuck in between, you know, when we talk about this group, and I put me with it, because I really feel, I really connect with this group that Rosenzweig is talking about, is like the ideal student, you know, the use case, the persona of a student. And I love that, like, you know, his answer here isn't, we're not going to shout at them from the sidelines. His answer is, like, at the folks, to say, like, come on, you know, help me in or whatever. You don't do that. He says, let's build a room, right? Let's make it. Okay, that's designer right there. That's designer energy. Like, way to go. Way to go, Franz. Okay. So that's why I love this, is that, like, just make it. Don't even stop. Just bam. Let's just go in and let's make this. Okay. All right. So I love that chutzpah. So that chutzpah appeals to me. I really like that. And I'm sitting here thinking, who is this guy? Right? Like, I hear that language and I'm like, wow, like, this is bold. You know, I could see a lot of disagreement, a lot of machloket, a little argument, friendly argument coming from this. Okay. All right. So Franz, he's born 1886. Right, into an educated middle class German Jewish family. He studies medicine, and then history and philosophy. So he's a triple threat. He gets really deep into German idealist philosophy, right? So think like Hegel and friends. And also, he's connected to and learns a lot about Christian theology. And at one point, he actually seriously considered converting to Christianity. And he gave himself a little caveat, which I love, such a Jewish thing. He says, all right, before I decide to do this, let me at least, like, experience Judaism, like, in its full breath, right? And in his words, quote unquote, from the inside. Okay, I love that. I love that, right? So here's the story. He goes to synagogue on Yom Kippur, and, you know, the Day of Atonement. And that experience is so profound that it turns him around, right? Maybe it was during the Kol Nidre. I don't know. Instead of converting out of Judaism, he turns back inward towards Judaism, right? Inward. That's the key part, is that Judaism goes within. So from this pivot, he now creates this big philosophical work, and it's called The Star of Redemption, Der Stern der Erlösung. Hope I did that right. It's a dense one, but it's one of his core intuitions, is that revelation isn't just like a abstract lecture to humanity. So like when prophets say, oh, this is coming and this is happening, you know, blah, 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 and we get prophecy, you know, it's an addressing from God to real people, right? An I and thou, an I speaking to a thou, right? We've heard that before, right? A little Martin Buber there. So thinking about this, right? If revelation, if prophecy is that concrete and relational, then, and it, you know, it's like, wow, yeah, we could really grab onto it. We could really make that connection and really go, wow, like it just hits us in the kishkas, right? Right in the good parts, okay? Then learning has to be concrete and relational too, okay? It has to be, right? That intuition is what, you know, led him from books, I think, to really getting and building the Lehr House and saying, let's get this off the pages and get people doing this. Because there's another component here. There's people, right? Like what happens when the learning happens? I think Rosenzweig does a good job of asking, you know, telos, to what end, which is a Jewish futurist practice here. It's like, where's this going? What will it mean, right? What will it mean to us? Will it cost a lot of money? Will it cost a lot of time, right? Like, what do we got to do to make something that we're talking about here, prophecy, right? And the revelation of these things and what they mean to us, right? As a conversation from the creator, then how do we put that into action so that like we can materially improve our lives, right? That we can deal with things like stress. We can improve our families. We can improve our learning. We can improve our institution. Just build better civilization, right? Like that's at the core of this, I see, right? And I'm sure Rosenzweig knows, right? Being an educator, we know education's at the core of what drives so many things, okay? And open education, okay? So in October now of 1920, right, in Frankfurt am Main, Rosenzweig, he opens up the Freies Jüdisches Lehrhaus, which is the literally means free Jewish house of study. And, you know, Freies, I hope I'm saying this correctly, means independent, open, right? Also means no grades and no degrees, right? You don't get a badge or a certificate, okay? You just get learned. You walk out with a bigger brain. Okay, Yiddishes means Jewish, and it's not about Judaism as a topic, but this is specifically a place for Jews to live and learn and eat and connect as Jews. That's the point of it, right? The being the Jewish part of it, and Lehr House, which means learning house, right? House of study. It's like a German language, a Beit Midrash, right? Which was a yeshiva, a Jewish house of study. So let's picture an evening, right? It's after work. People come in from their jobs, right, to this beautiful place. You know, it's maybe gas lantern lit. You know, it smells like coffee or maybe some sweets or something like that. Who knows, right? We don't know what was on the menu from the book. But we've got folks like who are clerks, work in public offices, lawyers, teachers, students, police officers, right? Like they're wearing their city clothes, their uniforms. They have tired faces. In very complex lives, they're on their way to something else after this. They're not done for the day. Some are observant, right, religiously. Many aren't, and a lot feel like they're standing like just on the edge. They describe just on the edge of Jewish life, and they're just kind of like watching and not sure how to like step in and begin. Right, it's like just feels like there's a wall that you can't surmount to do it, and. You know, this space, it doesn't look like a traditional classroom or even a traditional yeshiva. There aren't long wooden stenders, right? There aren't students yelling rapid fire Aramaic, you know, like chanting and reading, which is also beautiful. But it also isn't like just a big old lecture hall, right, with a professor just drone and on and on and on, right? There's way more dialogue. Things are broken down, right? More sense that the people there that are in the seats are the ones that matter, right? It's user-centered, which is, again, right, a chief design principle. So the Lehrhaus here is designed specifically for Jews who are highly educated, right, in German culture and language. So communication, they understand relevancy and context, and they feel a little bit separated from traditional Judaism, but they don't want to lose it. Right, they don't want to jettison the booster rockets there when they know it's like, oh, man, I know it's cool, and they might want to connect in a way, but they, because they've been studying so much secular and non-Jewish philosophy, religious philosophy as well, their minds grow in different ways, you know, and it's like Judaism has to kind of fit into that space. So it's, you know, you're kind of raising it from within. There are also people who are not making Aliyah, so they're not going to the British Mandate of Palestine, at least not right now, right? They're content to stay in Germany at this time. And they also want a serious adult way to engage their Jewishness without pretending to be someone that they're not, right? Like they might not feel like they could connect with some folks because they don't have the look. They don't might not have the beard or the peyote, right? The curls. They might not wear the clothing, or you know. And I'm describing Orthodox, right? Even Lubavitch Jews, Haredi Jews, who follow that aesthetic. And because there's Jews of all kind, you know, and they have different religiosity, right? That they put onto things in different ways culturally, as well. But that's the thing. It's like, we know if we're being authentic in that space or not. And I think that's important that this value is established here, because it really lets people be where they are. And I appreciate that. That's user-centered again. So the core question that Rosenzweig has here is, you know, what kind of space is really a learning space that could meet all these people where they are and still pull them into a deep connection or a deep contact, even just for a moment, right, with Torah and tradition. You know, what is it? What is it that these folks need? So, you know, that's where like things like food and being able to like you know, come and hang out and chill, and you know, the Lehrhaus today, you know, it's like more of a coffee shop and classrooms and things. You know, I believe, I need to confirm, but I believe in the old Lehrhaus you could take a nap if you needed, or get away, you know, for a moment. But you know, it's interesting that like, you know, you think about how do we make this space really work for the people so that like they can get to where they need to be. You know, their material needs are met, their spiritual needs are then met too. That's profound. So that's good design, right? Right there is the bridging of systems. So it's pretty cool because like now there's this thing that Rosenzweig talks about called Neues Lernen, right? Which is new learning. And he writes this as a short little kind of text, this is what we said earlier that translates to on Jewish learning. So this new learning, which is great. It's also the same time, about the same time, Die Neue Typographik came out, right? The new typography by Henri Vandeveld, right? Absolutely was or Dreyfus, my bad, Henri Dreyfus put that one out, and that is like a set of rules for typography that the world followed. Amazing. So here we got new learning, right? I'm sure there was a lot of new things coming out at that time, you know, blue skies, 1919 to 33. So in this text, he talks about the old model of learning. He says starts in the center in Torah, Talmud and commentary, right? All the other things. And then it moves outward into life. Right? So you like start in there and it's like a pure space, and then you can move outward. Not everybody gets the chance to do that. And you know, this worked when Jews saw themselves near the center, and like I think can happen for folks if they want it, but not all Jews see themselves that way, right? Or even see that behavior as being closer to the center, frankly, right? There's some things that some Jews do that, you know, it's not that the folks I mentioned earlier who are Orthodox, who have that aesthetic, that they're more Jewish than anything. They just have that aesthetic because there's other ways to be Jewish and have the look that, yeah, it shifts and changes. But we're talking about modern Jews here, right? Jews in the 20th century now, right? Who they live in a much wider world. It just we just ended a world war. And you know that model, the previous model of starting inward and moving outward, that one fails for that community. It just doesn't work. And you know, he talks about you can't just drop folks who aren't raised that way into the middle of the sea of text and expect them to swim and survive. They're not, right? So I love this. He talks about flipping, and oh my gosh, right? If you're a teacher, you know about flipping the classroom. It's this amazing, amazing thing that we do. And he makes this argument that new learning has to start at the periphery, right? So he's talking about this is how the philosophy works to describe how we're connecting to people who are at where they're at, and generally at the edge of Judaism, right? Spirituality of Judaism. And you know, that they then get to walk inward to the center, bringing their whole selves. So you begin where you actually are, right? And you do get this sense of elevation. You know, you do change, you do evolve, but you do bring your whole self, your whole vessel. Some parts may empty and some parts may refill, right? So they come with their jobs, their stories, their family dynamic, their sexuality, right? Their memories of war and peace, politics, doubts, art, music, all the things. And then from there, you invite them in towards Torah, right? You make the connections between all those things and the Torah. And that's amazing. So, this line that I pulled, like, really absolutely just grabbed me, right? And it said here that old learning began from Torah and moved into the world, and new learning must begin from the world and find its way back to Torah. I love that. I just thought, wow, that's very much what I believe in for a Hidor alum, and I think that's a really profound thing. I didn't know what to call it yet, you know. So I'm so delighted to come across this, and to understand what the Lehrer House and what Rosenzweig was talking about when he was putting these things into action in that space, because he's not abandoning the Torah as the center at all, right? He's just redesigning the path to get there, right? He's just illuminating different footsteps. That, you know, not every Jew has to go through things in this kind of, you know, thoroughbred, purebred kind of way. You know, it's like we all have different lives and experiences in the diaspora, and not all of us have the opportunity to, you know, make that connection to things in that way. You know, like to be so close to the center, so to speak. And again, also my argument here is, there's no exclusive hold on what the center is. So those things are being discovered. I want to discover them too. That's really, really important. I don't know, right? I want to know. And think about this, like let's get into an evening here at the Lehrer House, right? The one way back in Frankfurt. And let's think about what this place looked like on the ground, right? You might walk in, you're hearing, you know, some food made. You know, we talked about some of the smells, the sights. You'd see people kind of in groups, gas lit maybe, you know. And you might see some signs for classes on doors or whoever, however they did it, that might say like Bible and modern poetry, right? Or prayer in the modern self. So, you know, you show up curious and, you know, maybe even a little skeptical. You know, that's kind of what the crowd is. And you walk in, you know, at the front would be a teacher. It might be Rosenzweig himself, could be a rabbi, could be another kind of thinker, right? Philosopher, artist, who knows, poet, we don't know. And around you, right, you're sitting in the class, there's all kinds of men and women of different ages. And some can navigate Hebrew, and you know, others barely know their alphabet, right? And the session doesn't open up like a yeshiva and they say, you know, open up to a page, blah, 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 or you know, a study or a hymnal or something like that. It might start with like a icebreaker question, like, when in your week this week did you feel like time slows down or speeds up? Whoa, right? Like, love that. That I'm instantly in the flow state when I hear that, because that's what he's describing. And then, what does prayer mean to you, if anything, right? And just get people's opinion. Just go around the room and ask, like, what people think about that. And you'll take the temperature of the room in like 4 minutes, man. It's amazing. It's amazing. These are great things. And I like this one is, when was the last time you felt deeply Jewish? And where were you when that happened? Right? Like, describe the context. And you'd probably hear people answering these questions in German, right? And they'd be saying, you know, I was with my life, and you know, I maybe I was in synagogue or at my father's funeral or I don't something, you know, or the battlefield maybe. You know, there could be all kinds of stories, and you know, you'll hear about the trenches and trauma and things like that. You might hear about office boredom, or maybe falling in love, or somebody seeing anti-Semitic graffiti on the street the other day. Or somebody sharing that they just feel completely out of place in their synagogue. They just can't connect with the community for some reason. And only after that conversation segment of the course to open up and begin the course does a teacher then look at text. It could be a psalm, right? Tehillim. It could be something from the prophets, the Navi, or it could be like some rabbinic commentary from the Talmud or the Gematria. So, or you know, it could be a passage from the Star of Redemption, right, by Rosenzweig, his own text. It could be something that you know enters the room, right, already vibrating with real life, right. It could be something that's like just so exciting, and now it's like, oh, and because you're in this new f state of mind of flow, right, we really see that occurring, and then like this immediate reflection, it's awesome. Right, you really can then enter a text like it's like, oh man, it's like jazz. You got to let it kind of wash over you. And you know, it really helps a text, especially ancient ones, not land like a museum piece or like an artifact, right? Like that's the important thing that's really important here, that it synthesizes with your state of being. And we'll look for things that like can comfort, can challenge, can confuse, or reframe what we were just talking about, right? Like that's the wonderful, wonderful thing about it, is that like we have empirical knowledge because we've had a discussion and we've thought about things and reflected on them, and then we can look at a text, right, and see another perspective, which is really, really amazing. This is an evening at the Lehrer House, right? And then we'd end, you know, everybody, hey, thank you for the class, you know, like maybe even an activity could happen. And like after like an hour and 15 minutes, yeah, it's like you're done. And then cool, you can come back the next night or next week or when you want to, right? Or you yourself could be like, I'd like to teach a class, like I thought of. So I'm going to be teaching a class at the Lehrer House up in Boston in this summer on Jewish Futurism and Hidora Olam. Super excited. Right. So I can't wait to put these principles into action. I'm just so excited that that's going to happen. Okay. So, you know, we're talking about these kind of parallel spaces politically, educationally, religiously for Jews at the time. Right. We talked about Zionism and Bundism and all these different things. So let's look a little bit about how it parallels with Zionism itself, because it's not an exclusive thing. There's things that overlap, but are different at the same time. So in those early years, right, in the British Mandate of Palestine, you have Zionist pioneers, right? They're out there. They've now emigrated to this space. They're on land that was purchased. Okay, again, just need to be restated that land was purchased, not taken, but purchased. Okay, there was no armies or anything like that. There was no European forces coming to do these things, and the British were in control. They were the colonizing force at the time after World War I. So just we need to state those facts there. Okay, and at the time here, these early pioneers, they're draining swamps. They're establishing kibbutzim, which are, you know, these very kind of socialist communities where they're self-sustaining. And they're building the first the village, then town, and then city, and now metropolis of Tel Aviv, right? And laying the groundwork for an eventual Jewish state. You have artists like Boris Schatz. They're running the Bezalel School and has been since the 1900s, okay, in Jerusalem, trying to create the modern Jewish national identity and aesthetic, right? This is really now starting to unfold. And there's like about one generation or so in this space that's been working through the Bezalel School. And yeah, Hebrew's the spoken language. It's being revived in many Jewish communities around the world. And then is the preferred language of people who are in Israel at the time, right? In the mandate for Palestine, the people who had Palestinian passports. These are also the people who established the Palestine Post, the Palestine Electric Company, Palestine Trains, Palestine telephones. I mean, these were things that like Jews and Arabs, some Arabs, okay, worked together to do, right? There was once upon a time people got along and still do, right? There's that community that does exist still in the land of Israel today that are Arab descent who were there during that time and decided not to flee, right, when the surrounding armies came in. And decided to be a part of the nation of Israel. They were never forced to give up their religion or their land or change anything. They were just given a passport and then were provided with services. Okay. And then also re had requirements. Okay. If you are an Israeli citizen, you do have to serve in the military, right? As a mode of defense. It's an unfortunate thing. It'd be great if the nation never has to do it again. That would be a glorious day. It really would. But it does happen. This is a moving the center of Jewish life now to this place, right, from other places around the world, because the center of Jewish life had been in other parts of the world, the United States, Europe, and in other small communities. So now this new identity, this new Jewish identity, the Zionist is coming into existence, right? And it's well underway. The whole thing of renewing Jewish peoplehood on Jewish land, that's what Zionism is the self-determination of Jewish people on their land in some way, shape, or form, right? And because when the Israel wrote their constitution and declared independence before the war, there was absolutely written in there that they wanted to work with their neighbors to build a strong region, right? And prosperous space that materially benefited all of the people who lived there, right? To live in peace, right? That's the key thing. So that's the hard part here, right? That we're always dealing with is like, how does Zionism exist? How is it set up in this way, right, internationally through all these other nations, right, saying yes or no, when it's one of the greatest indigenous stories of homecoming of people to ever exist. So, Rosenzweig's big move here is educational and spiritual, right, in comparison to Zionism, right, which has more actionable items. And it was to build a center of Jewish life in Frankfurt, right where folks were in the diaspora, but do it through learning, right? Use education to inspire this next generation of great Jewish thinkers. And Rosenzweig never campaigns against Zionism, but his main energy, where he's putting his efforts, is going into what you would call a diaspora-based strategy for Jewish survival, right? And depth, right? So that came in the form of ongoing adult education, communities, okay, it's important, of serious and welcoming study, and a completely redesigned path between modern experience and an ancient text like Torah. You can think of it like this. While Theodor Herzl's followers were making blueprints for a Jewish future in the British Mandate of Palestine, Rosenzweig was sketching a blueprint for how deeply Jewish, fully modern Germans might live in the diaspora without evaporating. Both are very futurist projects. They just have different methodologies and different tools to achieve their outcomes. So this is fascinating to talk about all this and to also know that this happened 100-something years ago, and the Lehrhaus idea didn't die with Rosenzweig, but some of us just never heard of it, right? I'm speaking with so much profundity because I think this is really cool, and it's so nice to have discovered in this way during this process of creating my own Jewish creative education system. And there's a lot of contemporary projects to note, and there's independent Beit Midrash spaces that kind of do a blended model. There's Limud style gatherings. They're like living room circles, learning circles, where adults with complicated lives, you can show up and you can do a little bit of serious Torah. I remember being in Israel and in this graffiti artist studio, and all of a sudden this guy walked in and he's like, "Hey, you want to study a little Tanya? We're going to do a little reading of the Tanya." And I was like, "Okay, Cool. Yeah, let's do it. And it just was really cool to do it in that space and not be like, not feeling like, wow, this isn't a Beit Midrash, So that was really cool. So, y'all, if you're in the Boston area, or you've seen what's happening here, you know that a learning space literally uses the name Lairhouse, if you've been keeping up with what we've been talking about here right now. And it is a part study hall, part public house, where Jewish learning and food and community like all mix in this beautiful space. I'm so excited to get up there and see it. And the whole vibe of it is like super Lair House. I just think you can't sleep there. So adults in the middle of real life doing deep Torah from exactly where they are, who they are, not from some like position where they think they're, living out some persona that they think they have to be. They just get to be themselves and connect with the Torah in a super special way. So to me, these projects, right, in Boston and elsewhere, really the great grandchildren of Rosenzweig's Frankfurt Lehrhaus. They carry his intuition that adults deserve demanding, welcoming Jewish learning, yet meets them where they're at on the edges and helps them walk inward. So that brings me to my own work. And in my classroom and community workshops, I meet a lot of Rosenzweig's people, right? Folks who care enough to just show up, but who feel underqualified. Maybe they're overeducated or just out of place in classic Jewish settings. Some have some serious Hebrew school scars, right, that we gotta work through a little bit of. And some see themselves only as artists or coders or parents or activists or secularly Jewish, culturally Jewish. And it's like, it's good. It's all good. Like, just come with the curiosity. And a lot of them live online and, aren't sure how to be like physically in a Jewish space, but feel very much incredibly Jewish. So I like to borrow Rosenzweig's move here. I start with life, right? Like, I ask, like, what's lighting you up or weighing you down about being Jewish right now? Right? That's a real question that like people would love to just in a safe space get some stuff off their chest and learn and hear perspective. That's important too. I also ask things like, what tech or cool software, right, is messing with or amplifying your Judaism, right? So like, is there something that you're, is it social media? Is it some sort of game? Is it something that's like technology that's like helping or hurting and hindering your Judaism at the moment, right? This might be a two-way street. And then last is like, where do you feel most disconnected? And then where do you feel most at home when it comes to being Jewish? Really good, right? Just good, simple stuff. And we put that on the table and let people talk and share and make space, and hold each other. And then I'll bring in text, just like the Lairhouse model, and try to like ground it, make that connection feel connected, and a line from Bereshit or a piece of liturgy, a midrash, even a modern thinker, because our lives are already here in the room, and that text can land as a live wire, right? And really like be impactful and not be like some quiz or like something that's like, oh, like I don't even know what you mean. What does that even mean? Right? Feeling disconnected like that. It should be something that feels fluid with what we were just talking about as human beings being our authentic selves. That should feel like we're being our authentic selves inside a discussion about Torah, right? That's cool. So Hidor Olam is looking to do it in book form. And I list out the things that I set myself up for with prompts, and I keep it simple and grounded. And I talk about and show my sketches that I used in the creation of the artwork for each Torah portion. I would put together some kind of ritual. I'd map the places where I would feel divine presence. And only later, now I'm sharing this with people, and incorporating this explicit Torah and practice, right? Connection to those things. The structure walks you from life towards Torah. That was my intention, and that was the process that I went through when I made the Bereshit book. And then, back from Torah into creative action, what do you then do? What's the cycle, right? What's the loop closing? That's where reflection comes in, Right. What did I make of what I just did? What things am I going to take with me going forward? So, yeah, in that sense, right, Hedora Lum is a lot like a little paper version of Lair House. And this podcast is, is the audio version of that. So, I want to honor Rosenzweig, and I want to do a little tiny little audio Lair House with you right here and right now. So I'm going to start the way that he would, not with any verses, but with a question. So whether you are right now driving or walking or washing your dishes, just let this land for just a second. What makes Jewish learning feel real to you in today, 2026? Is it the people in the room with you? Is it the language? The risk that you might actually change something in your life, right, because of what you're learning? Is it the feeling of arguing with a text or the silence after you read a line that hits like really close? So Rosenzweig says old learning starts at the center and moves out, and now new learning starts on the edge of life and walks inward with your whole self. If we never move inward, we don't touch Torah. If we never start where we are, we don't really touch the inside of ourselves, right? We don't get to do that. So just notice in your own experience, where have you seen that work and where has it broken down? Have you ever sat in a classroom that started from your actual life and then led you into an actual text? Or have most of your learning spaces done the opposite? Starting in the text or starting in the theory and never quite making it back to you. I bet. I don't want to, over resolve or overstate that. I just want those questions to hang with you for a little bit, right? Let them ride with you into whatever comes next in your day today. That unsettled searching space, right, we all have is super, super Lair House. So, I want to land this not just in historical example, but I want to get this on your calendar, friends. On June 24th, I'll be teaching a Jewish futurist workshop that really calls a lot of plays from the Lair House playbook, and it's going to be at Lair House up in Boston. So we'll start off with real questions about being Jewish right now, right, in your city, on your feeds, and in your family. And then we'll plug those questions into text, creativity, and some of the scaffolded exercises that I talked about from Hedora Lum. Think of it as a pop-up Jewish futurism Lair House, part learning circle, part art studio, part design lab for the Jewish future, right? No budgets, just big ideas. If that sounds like your kind of a fun night, I'd love to have you in that room. So whether you're going to attend in person or follow along online, there's ways that you can get connected. I'll put the Lair House link in the description so you can check it out. So, Rosenzweig's big gift for me is the reminder that Jewish futures aren't only built by politicians or inventors. They're built in rooms where people like you and me learn and informs that we give these rooms, right? That the shape that we make these rooms, that will hold our future. And if we design Jewish learning as a performance that spectators only watch, we train ourselves to think of Judaism as something that happens elsewhere or is in the past. If we design learning as a lab, from life to Torah and back again, we can train ourselves to see Judaism as something that we can build with. So this week, try a tiny little experiment in that same spirit. Ask one person you know. This, what's alive and what's stuck in your Jewish life right now? And it might help if they're Jewish. Then listen, right? Just don't wait to speak, just listen, right? Then bring up one short little text in the middle of your discussion and just see what happens. See, like talk through the feelings and the things first, and then say, hey, have you ever read like blah blah blah? And you can pick whatever you want. Like, you don't have to do Torah. You could do something that's just like vaguely Jewish or even not, but just something that relates to this situation, to the here and now, right? Can you meet this person where they're at? right? And make a connection to a text in a profound way. So anyway, if you do this, if you try it, please, and if you end up joining me on June 24th, I'd love to hear your stories. So friends, you have been listening to Mike Wirth, the Jewish Futurism Lab. Thank you for staying after class with me and Franz Rosenzweig today. And I will see y'all in the future. Bezrat Hashem.